Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the latest display of presidential childish whining, this time on Saturday before a group of veterans and evangelicals, where the president attacked the media, again proclaiming that the fake media tried to stop us from going to the White House, but I'm president and they're not. A highly decorated combat veteran who was awarded 2 Silver Stars, 2 Legions of Merit, excuse me, 2 Bronze Stars and 2 Purple Hearts, Philip Butler, joins us. In 1965, he was shot down over North Vietnam, where he spent 8 years as a POW and is now a peace and justice activist with Veterans for Peace. We'll discuss what patriotism means on this 4th of July holiday in a country led by a man who has deliberately divided the American people against each other while attacking the press as the enemy of the people, and examine the uncomfortable possibility that Trump, who expropriated the patriotic mantle of the Declaration of Independence, proclaiming to the evangelicals that, quote, America always affirmed that liberty comes from our Creator, our rights are given to us by God, could in fact be proven to be a traitor. Then we'll look into Canada's celebration of its 150th year as a country, with its youthful Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, stressing Canada's inclusiveness as the country's First Nations Indigenous protesters set up a teepee on Parliament Hill calling for a reoccupation. Cleo Pascal, a visiting Trudeau Fellow at the University of Montreal's Centre for International Studies and a Fellow at the Royal Institute for International Affairs, Chatham House, London, joins us to discuss how her country is managing its relationship with its powerful neighbor, now headed by a leader whose policies could not be more different than those of Canada's Justin Trudeau. Then finally, we will examine what might transpire at the upcoming G20 meeting in Hamburg, Germany, at which President Trump will meet with Russia's President Putin for the first time. Catherine Stoner, Director of International Policies and the senior fellow at the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies and its Center for Democracy Development and the Rule of Law at Stanford University, joins us to discuss whether the meeting will be a love fest or whether Trump will try to act tough with Putin to distance himself from lingering charges of collusion with the Russians. And joining us now is Philip Butler, a 1961 graduate of the United States Naval Academy and a former light attack carrier pilot. In 1965, he was shot down over North Vietnam, where he spent 8 years as a prisoner of war. He's a highly decorated combat veteran who was awarded 2 Silver Stars, 2 Legions of Merit, 2 Bronze Stars, and 2 Purple Hearts. He completed his naval career in 1981 as a professor at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, and today is a peace and justice activist with Veterans for Peace. Welcome to Background Briefing, Philip Butler.
Good morning, Ethan. Thank you for having me back on again. You have an amazing program, and it's always a pleasure to be on.
Well, thank you, Phil. And obviously, we're not at the Kennedy Center on Saturday in Washington, D.C., with a group of veterans and evangelicals, or evangelical veterans, I guess, a very friendly, pretty much hand-chosen crowd by President Trump to have yet another rally leading up to the 4th of July, of course. I mentioned in the opening that he invoked God as providing us with our liberties, obviously throwing a bone to the evangelicals. But he also whined about his treatment by the press. And as you know, he's in a Twitter feud with MSNBC's Morning Joe and in a bitter battle with CNN. Did you see the tweet that he sent out today, by the way?
Yes, I did. You know, with this guy, I'm at a loss to know where to start and where to end. It's just amazing the stuff that goes on. It just boggles the mind of anybody who is thinking straight that this guy could possibly be our president of the United States. And I know I've discussed this with all my friends, and a lot of us have come to the conclusion that it might have something to do with the degradation of our educational system in this country. But I don't even know if you can lay it to that. I just don't understand how this guy got to be president, and then of course in doing that too, you can't put a period at the end of the Trump expose, you have to come to Congress and see what they're up to and how they support him and fail to uphold their constitutional, sworn constitutional duties to take this guy on. But as I said, where do we start and where do we end? Ian, tell me.
Well, not necessarily my job. I'm trying to extract information, not pontificate. But it would seem, though, it's a very strange thing that this president, who has no background in military, he got out of Vietnam by claiming he had a bone spur or something in his foot. He actually said on Howard Stern's show that my Vietnam was that I got venereal disease because he had so many girlfriends. And he's hardly a model Christian, thrice divorced. He's actually an uncouth pig of a man who says the most vile things. So I, for the life of me, I don't understand why the Republicans who, you know, believe in God and claim the patriotic high ground, what his appeal is. Because, as you know, Phil, a lot of our recent presidents have gotten a lot of grief over military service or the lack of military service. Bill Clinton got slammed and about his getting out of Vietnam. And he was also always, as a result, very deferential to the military when he was president. George W. Bush got slammed over his National Guard service. And John Kerry, who was a genuine war hero from Vietnam, they tried to slime him up and take that away from him with the Swift Boats for Peace people that Karl Rove organized. So it's a hot potato politically not to have any military service, but this guy, it doesn't matter. What's going on here?
Well, I have to quote my good friend Andrew Bacevich, who, by the way, is a member of Veterans for Peace and also one of our advisors to our national board. And Andy said this quote, "In present-day America, expressing reverence for those who serve in uniform is something akin to a religious obligation. Everyone professes to cherish America's warriors, yet such bountiful, if superficial, expressions of regard camouflage a growing gap between those who serve and those who applaud from the sidelines." End quote. I just love reading my friend Andrew Bacevich. He is so brilliant, so articulate, and he just nails it when it comes to stuff like that. And you know, we have this nutcase for a president who's doing all of this stuff. You know, he really doesn't care, I don't think, about presiding. I think what he cares about is promoting his own financial interests, which he's doing quite successfully now with his family and his other minions all around the world with his so-called Trump brand and hotels and things. You know, he continues to do that, and that's totally against the Constitution. You know, I just recently, as have most people, learned, not being a constitutional scholar, but have learned more about this emolument clause in the Constitution that forbids all this stuff. I mean, it's just incredible, but we have a Congress who will not uphold their constitutional, sworn constitutional right to uphold the Constitution because all they care about is their job. And, you know, just to say a couple of words about Congress, you know, this health care thing that went through where 26 million people were going to lose their health care, and a lot of them will die because of it, and then so-called tax reform, which is amounts to you have to get the health care first so that you can get the cuts to give bonuses to all the wealthy people. And I kept racking in my brain is how can they do this when even stupid people out there who aren't well-educated can see what's going on, and they're against this, and now you have an overwhelming majority of the public that is against this health care and this so-called tax cuts. And you would think that these Republicans in Congress, that their agenda would be to support their constituents, what their constituents want. But it suddenly occurred to me that their constituents aren't those people out there who voted them in. the constituents are the corporations and their corporate interests who gave them the trillions of dollars, you know, to use in their reelection campaign so that they could get reelected. It's a different constituency for those people. It's not we the people. It's the corporations that have taken over the military-industrial complex, just like President Eisenhower said many years ago.
And again, I'm speaking with Philip Butler, a 1961 graduate of the United States Naval Academy and a former light attack carrier pilot. In 1965, he was shot down over North Vietnam, where he spent 8 years as a prisoner of war. He's a highly decorated combat veteran who was awarded 2 Silver Stars, 2 Legions of Merit, 2 Bronze Stars, and 2 Purple Hearts. And he completed his naval career in 1981 as a professor at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, and today is a peace and justice activist with Veterans for Peace. Well, Phil, I've asked myself those very same questions, and you can see that the Republicans are struggling with this disconnect between their constituents, their voters, and their donors. In short, I've come to the conclusion, and I've done quite a bit of research on this. It's an extraordinary situation that that we are heading into a plutocratic future here in America. But it's not like the plutocrats bought the Congress. 2 plutocrats, the Koch brothers, essentially bought the Congress. They organize a group of donors and a number of networks. And that's why Ryan and McConnell and company are doing stuff that only favors plutocrats. And if you think about it, almost everything that has passed so far by Trump and the Republicans has been the Koch brothers' agenda. Getting out of the Paris Climate Accords, bringing back coal, opening up offshore oil drilling, bringing in the tar sands for Canada. And most importantly, the so-called repeal and replacement of Obamacare is a tax cut for the wealthiest, for the Koch brothers. And their main agenda is to get through the so-called tax reform bill, which will give them a permanent tax cut. That to my mind explains this disconnect that the Republicans find themselves in, where they're caught between their constituents, who they made promises to, and their donors who own them.
At the same time, they've relinquished over the years, I guess you'd say the past few decades, their military responsibilities, and they've relinquished turned those over to the President of the United States, who can apparently order any kind of military response to any country on the planet that he wants to. Supposedly Congress has been given the constitutional power to declare war, but they've relinquished it and given it over to the Commander in Chief. So there's basically not anything that the Commander-in-Chief can't do if he decides to do it. It's absolutely astounding, and it's terribly frightening, you know, when you see that our Commander-in-Chief is this nutcase, Donald Trump.
Well, I said in the opening that there is an uncomfortable possibility that in spite of all of his patriotic posturing in front of the evangelicals on Saturday, that he could be proven to be a traitor. I mean, isn't that an amazing thing?
A president as a traitor. I mean, what are his connections with Russia, for example? Yes, and what has he ordered his people to do? And that makes it even more dangerous, because he may try to prove himself worthy by launching a war someplace or using his nuclear codes to do who knows what. I mean, we've got all of this stuff going on all over the world, Ian. We've got stuff going on with North Korea, Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, and against Iran. It just, you know, and we've got all kinds of dangerous things going on with China in the South Pacific. It is a very dangerous world, and we have the worst possible case with this guy as President of the United States.
So he's a minority president. He was 3 million votes short in the election. We're the only country that doesn't have the first-past-the-post voting situation that all democracies have. So that's a bit odd to begin with. But being a minority president, what's wrong with the majority, the Democrats? I mean, here you've got the Republicans talking about repealing and replacing Obamacare. All the Democrats talk about is repealing Trump, in other words, impeaching him. That's what they're counting on. But they don't talk about replacement. They don't talk about what their policies are, what they do differently and better for the American people. So this guy could actually get reelected in the absence of any opposition in this country.
That's absolutely true. He definitely could, because the Democrats are not saying what they really stand for. They're not talking about the culture and poor people and health care and the things that the Democrats should stand for, and a proper tax code that is not regressive, and in giving the power of warfare back, taking power back into Congress, so that the branches of government become more equal. And though I admit I'm not being a constitutional scholar, perhaps getting rid of this electoral system that seems to be causing so many problems in the last several elections, and on. But you don't hear Democrats, like you say, where they're not talking about such things.
Well, on Saturday, before the evangelicals and the veterans, Donald Trump said, "We're going to start saying Merry Christmas again." So I guess it's all going to be good, right? If we can say Merry Christmas, then we're a free people. What kind of nonsense is that?
It is religious crazy stuff. One of the scariest things in this country to be, I guess, is an atheist, which is what I am, because that's the last bastion of repression and oppression in this country. Is being an atheist, you can't get elected to public office. You could be anything else but that. You could even be a Donald Trump and get elected to be president of the United States, but you cannot cannot say that you're an atheist. But I do think that is changing over time, that people are coming to be a little more sensible to that, just like they've come to be nationwide much more sensible to the
BTQ, XYZ, whatever.
LGBTQ issues,
Well, just in closing, Phil, what would your message be to your fellow veterans on this 4th of July patriotic holiday? Because it seems to me that we're in an odd situation in this country where it's actually patriotic to resist.
Yeah, I would say to my fellow veterans that support our troops. And the way to support the troops is to bring them home. And if you have any questions about how to do that, go online to veteransforpeace.org, and there's lots of information there to find out about who to join up with and how to do that. Bring the troops home.
And in terms of resistance, what can we do to come up with an alternative agenda and end the Trump era as soon as possible to save America from this menace?
Well, never think that you're just one person. You are just one person, but you have a voice, so use your voice. If you love this country, if you truly love this country, use your voice to support democracy, peace, and social justice.
Well, Phil Butler, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Eva.
And again, I've been speaking with Philip Butler, who's a 1961 graduate of the United States Naval Academy and a former light attack carrier pilot. In 1965, he was shot down over North Vietnam, where he spent 8 years as a prisoner of war. He's a highly decorated combat veteran who was awarded 2 Silver Stars, 2 Legions of Merit, 2 Bronze Stars, and 2 Purple Hearts. And he completed his naval career in 1981 as a professor at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, and today is a peace and justice activist with Veterans for Peace. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into Canada's celebration of its 150th year as a country.
find the cause of freedom buried in the ground. Mother Earth will swallow you, lay your I recall. I really don't know life at all.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Cleo Pascal, who's the Sunday Guardian's North American special correspondent, who specializes in geopolitical security and economic implications of environmental change from global warming. She is a visiting Trudeau Fellow at the University of Montreal Center for International Studies and a fellow at the Royal Institute of International Affairs, Chatham House, London, as well as a consultant for the U.S. Department of Energy and NATO and the OSCE. Her latest book is Global Warring: How Environmental, Economic, and Political Crises Will Redraw the World Map. Welcome to Background Briefing, Cleo Pascal.
Hi.
Cleo, happy Canada Day. Yesterday it was, right?
It was. Thank you very much. Merci beaucoup. We have to do it in French and English. That's, kind of mandatory on a day like today.
Okay. So you had this extraordinary bunch of revelers and protesters converging on the nation's capital in Ottawa on Saturday, where Justin Trudeau, the youthful prime minister, celebrated Canada's inclusiveness as its sort of political calling card. And he went on to say, we don't care where you're from or what religion you practice or who you love, you're all welcome in Canada. But there, of course, was a group of First Nations Indigenous people who set up a teepee on the Parliament Hill and called for a reoccupation. So let's start with the First Nations people. What's happening there?
Well, Canada's First Nations people have had an extremely difficult time, obviously, since the arrival of the Europeans. We've had forced taking of children, sent to residential schools, not allowed to speak their own language, in many cases abused. Canada's, as a country, has been trying to at least acknowledge some of what happened with our Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which went on for several years and took testimony from across the country and came out with a whole series of recommendations on how to move forward given this the ongoing pain in the community and the lack of understanding across the country of how bad it had been and how bad it still is. We have currently also ongoing unsolved cases of murdered and missing Indigenous women that needs to be addressed. Several thousand women have gone missing, and perhaps some are murdered. And it seems like those cases have not been investigated with the same alacrity as had they been non-Indigenous. So there are a lot of very serious outstanding issues that Canada needs to address, and hopefully slowly will start to address.
Well, I remember speaking to you a while back where you made the joke in referencing Donald Trump's call for a war with Mexico. A lot of Americans, when George W. Bush got elected, before he got elected, said, if he gets elected, we're going to move to Canada. And many people, in fact, more people said the same with Trump. And that you made the joke that the Canadians are going to build a wall and make the Americans pay for it. What's happening now in terms of, you couldn't have, as I mentioned in the opening, you couldn't have more different presidents and leaders and policies than those of Donald Trump versus those of Canada's Justin Trudeau?
Yeah, well, we have, Canada has a long history of being a neighbor to a rather unpredictable behemoth to the south. And in fact, Canada was, as you mentioned, it's the 150th birthday. And if you do the math, you'll realize Canada became a, or at least Eastern Canada became a country in 1867. And part of the reason was because, of course, the U.S. Civil War ended in 1865. And so there was this large army just to the south of us. And the Alaska Purchase happened at the beginning of 1867, and there was a great concern that Manifest Destiny might not just flow east-west, but also south-north. So we are used to living next to a little bit of unpredictability to our south. And in fact, it was one of the impetuses to create Confederation in the first place, to bring the different colonies together to be able to withstand any apparent assault or expansion from the United States post-Civil War.
So how did Canada quickly fill that vast vacuum in the West between the Eastern settlements and Vancouver? In other words, to stop the Americans from taking it all over in the West?
Well, that's a very good question, because there was the Alaska Purchase was the initial stage of what was conceived as a pincher move, where you would come up from the western coast of the U.S. and down from Alaska and grab British Columbia, which was particularly interesting kind of around the gold rush time. And the colony of British Columbia said, we will join with you, the new Canada in the east, only if you can get troops to us in time to repel a U.S. attack. So Canada very quickly, with unwilling aid of a lot of Chinese laborers, drove a railway through the Rocky Mountains in order to be able to guarantee to British Columbia that troops could get there to defend against the Americans. And that railway line was a highly strategic line. It was used as well eventually to get British troops to India and various other colonies coming from that side, coming from the east towards the west.
Hmm. And again, I'm speaking with Cleo Pascal, who's the Sunday Guardian's North American special correspondent, who specializes in geopolitical security and economic implications of environmental change from global warming. She is a visiting Trudeau Fellow at the University of Montreal Centre for International Studies and a Fellow at the Royal Institute of International Affairs, Chatham House, London, as well as a consultant for the U.S. Department of Energy, NATO, and the OSCE. Her latest book is Global Warring: How Environmental, Economic, and Political Crises Will Redraw the Map. So clearly, the differences in policies are pretty huge and between Trudeau and Trump. And Trudeau, of course, celebrated inclusiveness. Donald Trump just got his Muslim ban through, which excludes the country from which most of the terrorism has come, including 9/11, Saudi Arabia. It turns out, of course, that Saudi Arabia will turn into the piggy bank for Donald Trump's re-election. This young crown prince has given Ivanka $100 million for her foundation, and Jared, her husband, and the young Saudi boy king are making all kinds of financial arrangements for Trump's re-election. So that is pretty extraordinary to have a president who's still running a business out of the White House and could well get reelected because the Democratic opposition in this country doesn't have its act together and doesn't really have much to say except hoping this guy gets impeached. So from abroad, how does it look? Because there was a recent poll by the Pew Research Company that looked at the entire world and the shift in the global view of the United States around the world. And you have, not only are you Canadian, but you work out of London a lot and also work in India a lot. So let's turn a little bit to the Pew Research Center's poll and get your take on how America looks from abroad under the leadership of Donald Trump.
Yeah, I was in India last week, actually, at the same time that Indian Prime Minister Modi was in Washington meeting with Trump. And actually, the Indian, especially strategic and defense community, are fine with Trump. They had a lot of problems with Hillary Clinton when she was Secretary of State, and there was perception that She was very pro-Pakistan. And just before the visit by Prime Minister Modi to Washington, the U.S. declared one of the Kashmiri terrorists as an international terrorist, which is going to be very helpful in terms of cutting off his funding and tracking and doing all that sort of stuff. And I think that was a bit of a kind of a token, a gesture of hand of friendship to India to say, look, we've got a different approach to this. On Pakistan, we're willing to re-examine the relationship, especially when it comes to terrorism. And it's particularly important because China has been helping Pakistan protect some of the terrorists on Pakistani soil. So from the Indian perspective, it's a signal that at least some within the U.S. Decision-making community are willing to help India isolate some of the people that it thinks are responsible for attacks on its military installations, perhaps linked to Mumbai attacks, things like that. So from the Indian perspective, Indian defense and strategic community perspective, they've seen much more goodwill and willingness to cooperate across the entire Indo-Pacific, in fact, than they would have expected under a Hillary Clinton administration if her time as Secretary of State was anything to go by.
Well, specifically, the Pew Research Center's study on international attitudes of how they shifted on the United States under Donald Trump said that 40% of Indian respondents had confidence in Donald Trump compared to 58% for Barack Obama. So, but of course, I would think that Trump's Muslim travel ban plays well with Hindu nationalists.
Yeah, I think think that there's no question that, you know, that Barack Obama would have done better. But what's more relevant for now is how Trump would have compared to Clinton in the Indian mindset and sort of the general. But there's also kind of India, a billion people in India. And then there's like the core of the strategic community in Delhi. And that's a whole different thing, right?
Right.
And there's a lot of, the Pentagon has a dedicated unit. It's the only country-specific dedicated unit, which is just for speeding up cooperation with India. So there has been a perception since Bush, actually, that that the entire Indo-Pacific region would benefit from a better relationship between the U.S. and India. And those linkages go well beyond just the two guys at the top. You know, there's been a very long trust building since the nuclear deal, basically. I mean, nothing has come out of the nuclear deal itself, but there's been a lot more exchange, a lot more cooperation, intelligence sharing, that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. So if your concerns are China, for example, then this pathway is promising. And that's going to, that would, you know, it might have been slowed down under Clinton, and now it's being speeded up under Trump, but the relationship goes well beyond these individual leaders at this point.
So you're in London as we speak, Cleo Pascal. What is the attitudes in London in terms of where they think the United States is heading, particularly as this G20 summit is about to get away in Hamburg, Germany, hosted, of course, by Angela Merkel, who Trump has been absolutely boorishly rude to, in a totally gratuitous way, it would seem. He's insulted our closest allies while praising Vladimir Putin, who we'll be meeting with for the first time. And, of course, the U.S. intelligence community believes that Vladimir Putin actually directed the meddling in the U.S. elections.
Yeah, so the situation in the U.K. is a little bit different than the situation in Europe, because the U.K. itself is in the process, of course, of re-examining all of its foreign relations in the context of Brexit, right? And the U.K. economy and the U.S. economy are fairly compatible, and Trump has been very positive about Brexit. So if you're, you know, again, I'm not talking about kind of the mass of the UK population, but if you're kind of in the core of the policy community, you need to have a good relationship with the US if you're going to be able to position yourself post-Brexit. So, you know, you can't take a line like Merkel or Macron where you're being visibly antagonistic, because the UK itself is in the process of trying to find a new place, and the US economy is still by far the world's largest economy. There's compatibility of language. There are a lot of people, movement from both sides. The city and Wall Street have a lot of exchanges. So again, these deeper relationships, and especially because the UK itself is in transition, dictate a much softer approach, at least visual approach between Theresa May and Trump. She can't do what Macron did, even if she would have wanted to, because it would just be potentially too damaging to what's now a changing and vulnerable economy.
But my understanding is that a lot of pundits have said that in the recent election that she called for, hoping to extend her narrow lead in Parliament, in fact, it blew up in her face. And part of the analysis of why she blew it so badly in the recent election she called for was that she was perceived by the British people to be too close to Trump, and that Trump is deeply unpopular in the UK.
I think that there were many, many errors committed during the election campaign. A lot of them had to do with the manifesto, which they put out, which hit their core voters. They were talking about kind of healthcare caps that would have affected the elderly and unlocking pension promises and things like that. Like it was kind of a suicidal manifesto. It was a bit insane. So there were many, many domestic factors that affected the vote. Plus, Corbyn turned out to be, quite charismatic, and he managed to mobilize the youth vote in a way that was unexpected. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how big a factor Trump was. The old expression, all politics are local.
Sure.
And in this case, a lot of the discussion that was going on had to do with kind of nitty-gritty things in the manifesto or personal popularity or, what was going on in individual ridings.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, then, returning to Canada, Justin Trudeau is so different from Trump, but he's been careful not to antagonize him because Trump takes things very personally. How do you think that relationship is going to pan out over the next few years, assuming that Trump is not impeached?
Yeah, I think it'll be fine. I mean, Canada immediately, our global affairs, which is kind of our Ministry of Foreign Affairs, immediately put together a team just dedicated to handling our relationships with the United States and the White House. And we're very focused as a country on ensuring that it's a healthy, productive relationship for all involved. And there's a lot of targeted outreach to border states. So Canadian government officials work a lot with states along the Canadian border and work to try to help Washington understand how important Canada is to those economies. And those economies happen to be kind of heartland voters. So, swing states that are important for Trump. So there's a complex, mature attempt to make clear what the relationship actually is beyond the headlines and to leverage our deep and old relationships while still maintaining, ever since 1867, a wary eye on what's going on down south.
Well, Clea Pascal, I thank you very much for joining us here today. Cleo?
Hello?
I thank you for joining us, Cleo. Do we lose you? Okay. And again, I've been speaking with Cleo Pascal, who is the Sunday Guardian's North American special correspondent, who specializes in the geopolitical, security, and economic implications of environmental change from global warming. She is the visiting Trudeau Fellow at the University of Montreal's Centre for International Studies and a Fellow at the Royal Institute of International Affairs, Chatham House, London, as well as a consultant for the United States Department of Energy, NATO, and the OSCE. Her latest book is Global Warring: How Environmental, Economic, and Political Crises Will Redraw the World Map. We're going to take a brief station break and be back examining what might transpire at the upcoming G20 meeting in Hamburg, Germany, at which President Trump will meet with Russia's President Putin for the first time.
Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Catherine Stoner, who's a director of the International Policy Studies and a senior fellow at the Friedman Spogli Institute for International Studies and its Center for Democracy Development and Rule of Law at Stanford University. She's the author of Resisting the State, Reform and Retrenchment in Post-Soviet Russia and Local Heroes, the Political Economy of Russian Regional Governance. Welcome to Background Briefing, Catherine Stoner.
Thanks.
And Catherine, what do you think is going to transpire at this upcoming G20 meeting between Trump and Putin? They're meeting for the first time, although I think during the campaign, Trump actually said that he knew Putin, but that was because they'd both been in the green room on separate occasions. But nevertheless, obviously, there's a lot of anticipation for this meeting. And to what extent do you think it will be a kind of bellwether of whether Trump, whether it's going to be a love fest or whether Trump will try to act tough with Putin to distance himself from these lingering charges of collusion with the Russians?
Right. So I think it's so first of all, it is a general G20 meeting and not specifically a meeting or a summit between Putin and Trump, of course. But they've only ever spoken, as far as we do know, by phone shortly after the inauguration, and I believe there's been one other time that they have spoken on the phone since then. So this will be the first, as you said, face-to-face meeting. It is, though, in the context of the broader G20. Russia, of course, used to be a member of the G8 and then was kicked out in 2014 over the annexation of Crimea and its ongoing altercations, let's say, in the Donbass region or in Ukraine's civil war there. So this will be the first time they see each other. It's I mentioned that it's in the context of the G20 because they are, as far as we know, not scheduled to have a sit-down private meeting as much as they may have some sidebar discussions. So H.R. McMaster, the National Security Advisor, has said that they have, quote, no specific agenda, which is actually pretty shocking since there should be a lot of things on the agenda.
Well, that's where a lot of people are nervous, are they not? That Putin has always been well prepared at these prior meetings and that you simply can't wing it with Putin.
Yeah, so he has knowledge of facts as he knows them, and they're not necessarily universally accepted facts. But he certainly has the Russian perspective very firmly down, and he is able to conjure up a lot of numbers and whatnot. And it's not at all clear that, well, I think it's pretty clear that our new president is not a policy wonk per se, and doesn't have those facts at his fingertips. I think it makes those of us who watch Russia and Russia-U.S. relations closely a little nervous to hear that the National Security Advisor says we don't have a specific agenda when 17 intelligence agencies have concurred that there was interference from Russia in our elections We obviously have sanctions on Russia still. And so to not raise the issue would be odd. I think most people would consider that odd, yet no mention of it so far in anything that they'll raise. Obviously, you would think Ukraine would be an issue. The peace process there is stalled, and that is also linked to our sanctions against Russia. So there's that to talk about, and then there's also Syria to talk about as well, and ISIS, and then there are also issues with arms control. So there's a pretty full agenda, and to just exchange pleasantries would be a missed opportunity, of course.
So you don't think, though, that obviously Donald Trump is really frustrated by this Russian, he calls it a hoax, a witch hunt, et cetera, but it's not going away. And in fact, lately it's starting to intensify with the possibility that there may be some evidence of collusion now starting to emerge between a Republican operative who recently died and General Flynn. So do you think that kind of albatross, if you will, on Trump would prompt him to sort of be tougher with Putin, even though, as you point out, the agenda's not set for this meeting. Both McMaster and the economic advisor, Gary Cohn, has said that it's still being set. So do you think that might cause him to be not so much to be a supplicant, but to be an aggressor?
Well, you would think, but I don't think he's demonstrated himself to be an aggressor in any meeting so far, except the telephone call with the Prime Minister of Australia and his pushing aside the Prime Minister of Macedonia at the NATO meeting. So, you know, so far he has been a supplicant to Mr. Xi, the leader of China, and to Mr. Erdogan. So, from Turkey, when they have come to visit Washington and Mar-a-Lago, in the case of Xi. So, it's hard to see that he would necessarily do that. He seems to become quite enamored and enraptured by these strongmen, and so Putin is, you know, the ultimate strongman, and I think there's clearly there is admiration for one reason or another of Putin on the part of Donald Trump. I suspect this meeting will be largely a non-event, or we'll see Trump being overly effusive and friendly in an effort to show that they want to change the tenor of Russian-American relations.
Well, it's an extraordinary situation, don't you think, that there are some questions about the president and his relations with Russia and how deep they go? And we know that Russia colluded, that Russia meddled in the elections. The latest information coming from a leak from an NSA contractor indicates that they were actually getting deep into electoral systems around the country, at least between a third and a half of the states that they did electronic probing. And of course, Donald Trump has set up this commission to which most secretaries of state, or at least half of them, I think, have rejected, suggesting that it's a waste of time. And its effort is, of course, to provide some evidence to Donald Trump's charges that 5 million illegal voters gave Hillary Clinton the 3 million lead in the popular vote. But there's no effort on the part of this new commission to even look into Russian hacking of our elections. And here we are about to have our 4th of July patriotic holiday. It's pretty amazing, don't you think, that so far the Russians have gotten away with an attack on the very foundation of American democracy.
Yeah, I think what's breathtaking is not that they succeeded or that they attempted and evidently succeeded to some degree. I think the fact that they then weaponized that in the form of WikiLeaks and releasing that information, and then to have our president, our attorney general, evidently completely incurious about this. Jeff Sessions testified that he had not been briefed on this. That strikes me as incredible. How can that be? And how can he not be curious about it? And then Mr. Comey, former director of the FBI, testifying that the president had not even asked him about it. So I think, you know, the issue here is that the president has to let it go as being delegitimizing of his victory, and think about the public interest here. And the public interest is the integrity of our electoral systems. Russia has tried this kind of thing before. The Soviet Union has tried to interrupt or disrupt our elections in the past, and we knew about it. But I think what's different here is using it as a weapon against a particular candidate to influence the outcome. We'll never know whether or not it actually, turned the outcome one way or another. But to have the president of the United States unwilling and really kind of actively campaigning against having that investigated is just incredible. I mean, there's just no other way to describe it. And I should also mention, you mentioned two books I've written. I'm writing a third one now on Russia's ability to convey its power abroad and the way we think about power. And, we it's frequently said, of course, that the United States is the most powerful nation in the world. And by conventional measures, of course, that's true. We have the biggest military. We have one of the two world's biggest economies. We're incredibly creative. A cultural leader. All of that is true. We have a relatively healthy population, comparatively speaking, but that is not necessarily the currency of power and influence in the international system alone anymore. And Russia has it's at best the sixth largest economy in the world, rivals California's, but that doesn't overcome it. It's got a only 142 million people. It's going down in terms of population. Its GDP is, and GDP per capita are less than half of the U.S. GDP per capita. And yet here we are talking about Russia disrupting the very core of our international system. And we appear to be doing very little to stop it and prevent it from happening again. And as our leaders of national intelligence have said, they will be back.
So your new book, Catherine Stoner, does it explore this phenomenon where Russia has seemed to have perfected this hybrid form of warfare using these information campaigns, active measures, as the KGB used to call it, and developed these skills of destabilizing countries as they did the U.S. election and as they are doing throughout Europe? Through propaganda, through RT, through Sputnik, and through cyber warfare, operating beneath the threshold of war, albeit a new form of Cold War, where it's sort of, what would you say, a lukewarm war?
Yeah, I think it's the way I describe it in the book is Russia is a disruptive power, right? It's not in terms of sort of classical thinking about what makes a great power. Money, military, and human capital. Russia's not a great power, but it's a disruptive power. It's a good enough power in all of those areas, and it is unconstrained under Mr. Putin by institutions like Congress or a Supreme Court or even members of cabinet who can say, Vladimir, that's not a good idea. He can act very quickly, and actually in a manner that's quite different from Soviet power, the exercise of Soviet power. There was still, especially under the Brezhnev period, a collective leadership that could stop the general secretary from doing things, and the default tended to be not to intervene in places, but to be, more cautious. But then certainly Mr. Putin has been. Those checks and balances are not I'm not there anymore. Now, I'm not advocating a return to the Soviet Union. I'm not making an argument for authoritarianism. I'm just pointing out how Russia's able to use the power levers that it has developed. And, you know, technically, we have much better cyber capacity, but we haven't used it this way. We could, but we haven't. And, you know, we probably shouldn't. I would also say that, you know, Russia has attempted to intervene in elections in Germany, and obviously the disinformation campaign is all over the place. And I think that we haven't seen it be successful there yet, and it was not successful, of course, in France, despite giving Marine Le Pen, you know, several million dollars. The outcome was Macron won the election, so it doesn't always succeed in these attempts, of course. You know, at one point I was chatting with you about the Oliver Stone interviews that are on Showtime or have been on Showtime lately, the Putin interviews. And one thing I think we see in those interviews, there's nothing particularly surprising. It's very friendly to Putin, the whole series of interviews. But one thing is Mr. Putin at one point says, answering a question by Oliver Stone about the elections, he says, look, you know, it wasn't Russians, but these people, whoever they were, they didn't cause the trouble with American politics that currently exists. They simply exploited divisions that were already there. And that's, of course, true. And they tried to do that in France as well, and are trying to do it in Germany as well, and other parts of Europe. But they very successfully, in the U.S. case, you know, exploited the divisions that were already present in our own political system.
So just in the last 30 seconds, what do you think is the reason why Trump is so solicitous and even supine about Putin?
You know, I think there are probably several reasons. You know, on that the sort of more sort of sinister aspect could be that there is some kind of link, either money laundering in the 2000s, that is that Russian interests may have loaned him money when his businesses were on the rocks, and he doesn't want that revealed, and that might be why we don't see tax returns, because we'd see loans and whatnot, perhaps, or loan payments. Mm-hmm. That could be one aspect of it. The other could be that he knew that Flynn was in charge, or Flynn was interacting with this group that you mentioned at the opening of this segment of Republican operatives. And so this is why he's protecting Flynn. And then the third sort of more benign and slightly idiosyncratic thing with Trump is that he likes a quote unquote strong man. Mm-hmm. And Putin conveys that image. And, you know, Putin is put on magazines like Time. Right. The real covers that call him.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we're out of time, Catherine, but I thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And again, I'm speaking with Catherine Stone, who's Director of the International Policy Studies and Senior Fellow at the Freeman's Bogley Institute of International Studies and its Center for Democracy, Development, and Rule of Law at Stanford University. She's the author of Resisting the State, Reform and Retrenchment in Post-Soviet Russia and Local Heroes, the Political Economy of Russian Regional Governance. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.